Hi, everyone, and welcome to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And I'm Lizzie.
And if this is your first time listening, we're a medical
sort of
podcast where we try to discuss medicine and health in a relatable way.
And we'll answer questions you may not feel comfortable asking your doctor and definitely won't bring up to your friends. On today's show, we're going to talk to Joe Boswell, former staffer for Michelle Obama, who's kind enough to be here with us today to talk about his medical experience as a patient dealing with bipolar disorder.
Please make sure to like us on Facebook, review us on iTunes, tell all your friends.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and or medical needs or concerns. And I'm alive and I want to stay. For the first time I'm on my way. And I'm ready for the world. I'm ready for the girl. I'm ready to say.
Welcome back to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Joe.
And I want to know how you two are doing.
We two are doing pretty well.
You make it seem like we're a couple.
Aww, that's so
that
cute.
Would be awesome.
We're gonna post a picture of me and Joe in a warm embrace for the next episode. I'm doing well, you guys. I don't know if you know Joe, but last week my dog was in a car accident. Not
what?
Me, but my dog. She's fine.
So your dog was driving?
That's very clever.
Joe.
Well, not with you, then.
That's sort of adorable. Yeah. She was in a car. It got into an accident. We were on the news, the local news.
Oh, I did see that.
Kaveh posted it.
I did see
it.
But that, I think I'm crazy.
He made
it a while
look,
ago, right?
It was like a week ago.
Oh.
He made it look on the webpage that I was a hero. So I was pretty excited about that. But most importantly is that everybody was fine.
Yeah.
And my dog is fine. And the other dogs in the car were fine and retrieved because for a
Both
few hours.
Cars had dogs in them?
Just one car, the car, are you talking about your scenario where my dog was driving and another?
There's dog world and there's dogs
well,
that drive cars.
You said the other dogs, but I thought you only had one dog.
So
I thought the other car had dogs in
it. So my dog was driving one car and another dog was driving another. No. Anyway, everything was fine. We did post it on our webpage about the accident. And, you know, it's very shocking and sad, but everything is, everyone's okay.
Well, that's really good to hear.
Yeah. I'm glad Chloe's okay.
Not Lizzie? You don't care about Lizzie?
I wasn't there.
She wasn't in the car. This is a weird story. It's hard to describe exactly what happened. Everything's fine. There was a dog. There was a car. There was an accident. Everyone worked out okay. Now, I have something I would like to talk about.
Kaveh's not interested.
So, someone came up to me the other day. And they said to me, this is kind of funny. They're like, my doctor told me I needed to lose weight. But then I looked at my doctor and he was fat. So I was like, what the hell? And the person clearly did not trust what the doctor was saying, like the importance of
this
it.
This is because a patient of yours
No, this is just,
this is
a non-patient friend and a non-patient of mine at least. And they didn't trust what the doctor was saying because they felt the doctor was obese. What obviously the doctor didn't care that much about, you know, weight loss as an important thing for health. And two, they were a little bit annoyed because the doctor himself was fat. His fat, and they're like, "Why would I listen to this doctor who's fat? How can I trust what they're saying?"
That's very
interesting. We've talked about this kind of before, haven't we?
We have talked very early on in doing the shows about, I think I mentioned I have a colleague of mine who told a patient to lose weight. For specifically, I think we're talking about fatty liver disease, that you need to lose weight and exercise, and that person felt as if they were being quote unquote fat shamed because they were sort of felt like they were being scolded. And then we sort of revised that with the Dennis Lowe.
Pamela's question. About the fatty liver.
Yeah. And then we talked about with Dennis Lowe about how it's not, you know, I've actually changed my practice since hearing Dennis Lowe talk about it. I don't tell people to lose weight anymore. I say it's not necessarily a number. Don't weigh yourself every day. It's really about what you're putting into your body. It's about eating healthy, eating differently, and not. And we all know the number reflects that, reflects exercise, reflects making different choices. But it's not, I try not to say lose weight as a blanket, just isolated statement.
That makes sense.
I will still discuss weight loss, but I am much more mindful of the way I discuss it with patients. But that's not the point of this particular conversation. The point of this particular conversation was,
can you trust a lying doctor?
Can you trust the fat doctor? Like, no, if it's an unhealthy,
specifically related to you.
Yeah, of course.
You absolutely
if a doctor,
can.
Of course.
If a fat doctor tells you to stop smoking, you're like, ah, no, you're fat.
No, but that's my point is, what if there's a doctor who's smoking and they tell you to stop smoking?
It's a bad example.
Like,
thing,
can you
right?
trust the doctor who is, who isn't living what they preach? Can you trust them? Does that doctor lose its ability? It's almost like when you meet a famous person and the famous person is a jerk for whatever mm-hmm. reason, can you still listen to their art or watch their art objectively?
I think it's a great question, but I also talk to patients about weight loss, and I myself have been overweight. And I actually, if someone's really overweight and tells me to lose weight, I think sometimes it comes from a place of honesty. Like if they just say lose weight, that's inappropriate and sounds totally incongruent with reality. But if they say, you know, I know how hard it is to lose weight,
they could use it.
Yes, they can use
it.
And I have friends who'll say, you know, I have smoked a lot in my past, and I know this is what it's done for me, and this is why I stopped, and this is how I've stopped. So that's not, you know,
when
medical.
Lizzie talks to patients with a lot of herpes, she's like, I've had a lot of herpes in my day. I know how painful.
Yeah, I've had all the herpes.
Never mind. I'm not going to talk herpes anymore. Everyone thinks I have herpes now.
So anyway, I think that's a wonderful thing that, you know, someone would highlight, you know, can I believe this person? Are they being a hypocrite? But at the same time, like, you know, if the doctor just says lose weight without any sort of context, like, I think that that's a really, that I would also lose faith in them, whether they're skinny or fat, you know, you have to say, like, talk about it in real way without just saying
do it. It's hard. It requires a certain degree of sophistication. Not every doctor that's going to give you good advice is going to be a perfect picture of health. The smartest internal medicine doctor I've ever known in my whole life was a chain smoker. A chain smoker. And she would smoke packs a day, but she was the smartest person, still is probably the smartest doctor I've ever met. So you do have to, I think, separate that a little bit. I think that you're going to miss out on a lot of good doctors if you're looking for Dr. Oz every time, you know, someone who looks perfect. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I have thoughts about Dr. Oz. We can talk on another day. But I also think the doctor's job is to tell you, say, I don't know what your person was seeing the doctor for, but let's say they had high blood pressure. Let's say they had fatty liver. This obese doctor or overweight, whatever, still needs to say, you know, to get your blood pressure down, to help improve your fatty liver, you need to eat differently. You need to lose weight. It's still their job. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Right.
If you're a 10 pack a day smoker and your patient comes in with COPD, which is a chronic lung disease usually related to smoking, they still have to tell them whether or not they're a hypocrite.
Right.
It's their job.
Yeah.
That person, as we've talked about, should switch doctors if you don't feel like they're telling, being honest.
You have to separate it. And it's hard because, it does look hypocritical, obviously, but most people don't take their work home. And there's so many examples in every job where, gosh, this person is a specialist here, but yet when they go home, they live a completely different life. And that's human.
Yeah.
But I could see on the other side too, that if this doctor doesn't care, then why should I? He's the doctor or she's the doctor. You know, why would it matter?
I might be a hypocrite too, because I expect my patients to come and see me on a regular basis, or if they're having like a colitis flare, to let me know. And yet I don't go see doctors. Like if I have a problem, I'll figure it out myself. I'm a total.
Right.
I'll yell at my patients. Why didn't you tell me you're having bleeding? Why didn't you tell me you're having pain? Meanwhile, I would just sit and probably not go see a doctor.
Totally. My dentist has to call me like 18 times to get me to come in for a checkup. No, you're right. You're right. So not perfect.
No, I mean, I'm as close as it's going to get. Yeah. So along the lines of sort of just talking to patients and nagging them and preaching, please email hopquestions@gmail.com. Call 408-444-6623. Make sure to like us on Facebook, review us on iTunes, and tell your friends to listen.
Okay. Coming up next, we have Joe Boswell. He's a former staffer for Michelle Obama. He's going to talk to us about his experience working in the White House, living with bipolar disease, and navigating the medical system. Stick around.
We'd like to welcome Joe Boswell, who's here with us today, a former staffer for Michelle Obama, who in his own words came from the Nut House to the White House, who's generous enough to be here with us to talk about his medical experience as a patient getting diagnosed and treated for bipolar disorder, and is also currently working on a project involving his love of wine, because wine changed his life. Thank you for being here, Joe.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So let's just start with a little bit of your story.
Let's get into it.
Let's just get right to it. Tell us when you were first diagnosed.
Interesting. So I was 18 years old. I went to high school here in San Francisco. And I guess the quick version is I was sort of a golden boy in high school, kind of the captain of the football team, captain of the lacrosse team, sort of the male athlete.
Totally. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. You know,
Covey doesn't
you
know.
I think you feel me on that.
I can vouch for that.
But essentially, I had this, you know, amazing year, and I was got into Dartmouth for football and was, you know, sort of on my way to Dartmouth that summer. And I was with my two best friends in Europe. We were supposed to go to France, Italy, and Spain, and I only made it to France because in Paris, you know, it was hard to tell what was going on. Suddenly, you know, I couldn't really sleep, but we were partying a lot. So, you know, we were out at a club. I got beat up.
So it's hard to distinguish being 18 and partying from like maybe a disease,
totally.
Right?
Yeah, no one diagnosed right. me at that
You
time.
Don't pay attention when you're 18, no. like to your sleep-wake cycles, to health, to routines, to, you know.
Yeah, and we were going out late as it was.
Yeah.
So it was...
It wasn't that far of a stretch at that point.
No, it wasn't.
Before, looking back, do you feel like there were signs before that trip? We may have picked up on something.
So that's what's interesting is literally no signs, but no, I mean, no signs, you know, I was.
So you're in Europe, things are starting to go off the rails a little bit. At what point?
Very much so.
At what point do you know that there's a problem?
Well, so one thing, I was, of course, starting to feel very spiritual, which is hallmark manic bipolar. But I, you know, I definitely felt, you know, God within me and very powerful. But of course, that didn't at all faze me. I mean, I just thought
it was just
where I was. Yeah. But I guess the first thing is, so I have family members who actually have a winery in Burgundy in France. And we were supposed to go leave Paris and head out to Burgundy, to wine country. But things had already changed in the trip because of what I was telling you about the nightclub being beat up. Like, we were already kind of diverting from our normal schedule because things got crazy. And my two best friends got on the train to go out there, and the doors closed, and I didn't get on. So I was, like, left in Paris. And I don't know if I just wasn't fast enough or was I was thinking about other things or didn't really care about going out there. So once I was alone in Paris, then things really flew off the rails.
So your friends went to like your family's vineyard and you were stuck there.
Yeah. I don't know how far they even got.
Yeah.
But we were separated. I left everything all my belongings that I had with me at the train station. And just, so I just started walking around Paris. You know, at one point, I think I was just wearing like pants, no shirt, you know, no shoes. And this has happened now multiple times, but things kind of end for me, or no, not end, but like the mania ends when I go up to the police and ask for help because I'm literally lost, figuratively and literally lost. Mm-hmm. And of course, they don't have no idea what to do. They're like, what is this person doing? And then they're like, okay, we only have one option where to take this person, you know, because they're not going to, you know, there's no threat. They're not going to take you to jail. And then they're not going to take you to a regular hospital, but to a mental hospital is like the next
step.
Yeah. You know?
Is that what happened?
That's what happened in Paris.
So you went to a Parisian mental hospital.
Yeah, it was very luxurious.
Do you speak French?
You know, I studied French for many years, but I never really paid attention.
Yeah.
So not enough.
This story, I mean, immediately, and I don't want to interrupt, I want to keep going, but it, like, you just see all these people on the street in San Francisco walking barefoot or sitting in their own, you know, feces or whatever. And I immediately, I mean, you're... The audience can't see, but you're a well-kept, like, healthy appearing man. And just imagine how much psychiatric disease is out there on the streets because people don't have healthcare access or a place to store their medications, or they can't protect their medications from being stolen. Like, if you just had a place where you could get meds, like, and treatment, how much that could help, like, sort of you know, the world.
That's a really good point and a good question, and actually something I think about all the time. One thing my psychiatrist likes to say, which is on the same note of what you just brought up, she's like, yeah, I can see how people would be so lulled to sleep by you because, you know, you're smart, you're good looking, you're charismatic. People don't associate that with mental
illness.
Health. Yeah, they don't associate that.
It's interesting because, you know, going through medical school and when we first start to deal with psychiatric patients, and we both, and during our training, had to do in-house stuff with people who are hospitalized. When you're talking to someone who has an elaborate delusion, sometimes it can lull you in, because it's not that these people are dumb. They're smart people, and they have oftentimes very elaborate illusions and delusions that once you hear the story, at some point in your medical training, you're always like, wow, maybe the CIA is talking to him via the telephone, via the TV or something, you know? Yeah. And it can lull you in, especially if you are very high functioning as you are. Does it offend you if people look at you and they say, you don't look like you'd have a problem?
Not really. I think the bigger thing for me is just generally being humiliated by the situation and like what I've gone through and sort of what's happened. When they say you don't look like someone who's bipolar or crazy, I mean, in a way it's not like a compliment, but it sort of doesn't bother me at all. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like, I don't know. Like you, so look you like, it's like you look like a stud. Well, okay. I'm crazy. Like that's okay. You know, like if I was walking around and you thought I was crazy, that would probably not be
as good.
A good situation.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I should make it clear. Crazy is not like a word
Yeah.
If we
but
use
it's a
it,
word I use.
Right. Yeah. But it's not a word that we should use. And it's sort of, if
we could say the situation is crazy, but it's not politically correct or appropriate to call a person crazy. Cause it's just, it's like calling somebody oriental.
But I do like to say that I went crazy at that time. Because it's very something people can understand. It's user friendly.
Yeah.
You know, speaking in like, well, I was manic at that time, or that was an episode. A lot of people just don't understand that.
So will you explain to people who are listening to Joe, you know, what, I don't know if you know the medical kind of definitions, but like what bipolar disorder means for people.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I know the sort of chemistry with the brain, but I certainly understand that. To put it very simply, mania is like the real high in the episode. Depression is the low. There's bipolar 1 and 2. I'm bipolar 1, which is the big ups. And then bipolar 2 is like the quick cycles. And bipolar 2 is much more functioning. A lot of people are bipolar 2, probably a lot of people that you know who aren't diagnosed.
It's interesting that manic depression is actually sort of a great name for it. And I wonder why, because there's so many things in medicine, we've talked about this on the show before, that have changed, again, for political correctness. Like we don't say mental retardation anymore. Yeah. It's just very
interesting
that we're changing the names, because manic depression is very
fitting.
Like descriptive.
Yeah.
Because that's what it is. Mania is sleeplessness, spending, you know, hypersexuality, and depression is, you know, people sort of, I think, are more familiar with depression than mania for some reason.
It's a good question. And I guess you're saying it's for more political.
I'm not sure why. I'm just saying our experience as doctors.
I have no answer to that other than bipolar is just a much better name.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so much more user friendly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As comfortable as one can get, I feel comfortable with the term bipolar.
Yeah.
Manic depression is just like long and I don't know. Who knows? To me, it's bipolar sexier.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go with that.
Sure. Yeah.
Which brings us to the next question, which is how did you get from this Parisian nut house to working for probably the most powerful woman at the time? What happened?
Well, Michelle Obama.
Well, probably because I started working for her husband, and I was very honored to be asked to work for her. So the way it happened, the very quick story was, you know, St. Anne's, Paris, the hospital, then went to Dartmouth.
Sorry, very quickly. They diagnosed you right away. Because sometimes it's not that easy to diagnose. Because
I went,
is this schizophrenia? Is this psychotic features? You know, it's hard to diagnose.
I went for, I'm not trying to take the exhaustive route, but I can't get to the White House without quickly going through this.
Sure.
No, they didn't. They didn't diagnose me for a whole year. I never took any meds for an entire year, which was... That's pretty crazy. I mean, that's pretty unusual. I mean,
you can say crazy, just so you know.
No, I can say anything I want to say.
Kaveh can't say crazy.
He can too.
Okay. crazy.
But exactly. But anyway, so didn't get diagnosed, went to school. It was one of the worst years of my life because I was so down and depressed. I was known as the quiet kid from California, which you can obviously see. That's who I am at the core.
Yeah.
Super depressed. And there was one doctor who was like, you know, I think he might be bipolar when I came back from Paris. But he was like, I don't want to say that because then that's like, I don't want to diagnose him because then it's like screwing up his
future.
That'll
like go future. With him for yeah, the rest yeah, of his life.
Exactly. Right. Kind of like this podcast. Yeah. But that'll follow him around.
But that's why we want to have you on. There's a stigma, right? Yeah. Saying bipolar shouldn't.
Oh, there still is a huge stigma.
Yeah, but it shouldn't, you know, you should be comfortable talking about it. We should be, you know, we had Maz Jobani on recently, and he talked about going to a therapist. And I think just saying it, you know, I have bipolar and this is what I'm doing, and saying I go to a therapist to help me cope, that helps other people. So you being on.
I want to be the first bipolar president.
Yeah, there you go.
I think that's a good goal.
Super powerful. Things are crazy enough already.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we don't already have one.
Exactly.
I think we might have something worse.
Sorry to interrupt.
So just how'd I get to the White House? So Dartmouth, depressed. Then I had a manic episode after my freshman year. And you know, got through those 2 years super depressed, but then I didn't have anything happen for like 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. And after college, I went to New York for a year, worked at like a strategic communications, like crisis communications firm. And that's when I sort of had heard about Obama. This was like 2007. And started, you know, thinking, hey, no one knows who this guy is. I like what he's saying. I hated my job in New York. Mm-hmm. So I just literally started going to little volunteer meetings in New York before anyone, you know, no one I knew who he was, except for like some people from Chicago. And quit my job, got on a bus to Iowa, started volunteering, got hired like a couple weeks later, and worked in Iowa, Arizona, Texas, Pennsylvania, Ohio. And someone I worked with the second time I was in Iowa, she just like really liked my style and we got along. And when Obama won in 2008, she was asked to be Michelle Obama's chief of staff. Mm-hmm. And she contacted me and was like, what are you doing? And I was like, nothing. You
know? Oh my gosh.
And that was, that was kind of.
So at what point during this time did you actually start taking treatment or get an actual diagnosis?
So I think I got an actual diagnosis the summer after my freshman year at Dartmouth. So that would have been 2003, 2004 maybe. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, because I'd already had that episode or period in Paris. And then I had next issue in the Bay Area a year later. They were just kind of like, okay, this is obvious what it is.
Yeah.
So, and then I took meds, you know, the entire time after that. And I've taken it the entire time after that, except, and this is hard for people to grasp or understand. Mm-hmm. If it's like, if there is like a wave, you know, and the meds are keeping things kind of in balance, there comes a point where the wave breaks, mm-hmm. whatever that is going on. And that's when I stopped taking meds. It's not like, oh, I stopped taking them like months ago or weeks ago. Like by the time I stopped taking them, things are already that bad.
Yeah.
So you think that the worsening of the disease makes you stop medication for not like a rational kind of thought.
Yeah. Like what I would tell if I was ever going to coach people about it, and maybe one day I will, like someone told me this and it's so true. Meds are maybe like 25% of the whole picture of mm-hmm. self-care. I thought they were like 80, 90, 95%. As long as you took meds, you can do whatever the hell you want. Mm-hmm. That's not even close to true. And it's taken me 10, 15 years to figure that out, learning the hard way. But so my point is, you know, like I was just deluded, or I mean, there's plenty of delusion, but that's not what I mean. But I was telling myself that I could, you know, do whatever I wanted. So in that period you were asking about, I took meds the entire time.
Yeah.
But then later, you know, things got really strong and I wasn't able to take the meds when they got that strong. And my point is, if you get to the point where you're not able to take the meds, then like miles before that, you made big mistakes.
So was this like moments of, again, sleep deprivation, stress, you know, maybe we're at this point in the White House or working with, Michelle Obama. Do you feel like that is what sort of triggers it? Because you're saying there's so much about self-care that's part of the disease.
No, so that's interesting. I didn't really have any, you know, I didn't have any mania in the White House or any like big issues. But one thing that does happen, like I said, if you, And this is part of what that investor always said about making the same mistakes. I made the same mistakes many times. Like leaving, I stayed in the White House for a year. Leaving the White House when I did, that was a mistake. And it wasn't like a career mistake, even though, yeah, I could say that. But one thing about my bipolar journey, I can't speak for anybody else, is you can make a decision 6 months before or a year before something, mm-hmm. and that's like a sign of what's coming. You know, so there's like a little ripple here. You might not realize that like miles and miles down the sea, a tidal wave's coming. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So me leaving the White House after a year began this long manic process. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I found that over and over again.
What was your reasoning at the time for leaving?
My reasoning at the time, which I thought was great, and this is how I felt, is I had just been on the campaign for 2 years and, you know, what we were kind of calling bare chesting across the country, which I loved. Like that was maybe the best job I've had. Like I said, being in Iowa for almost 9 months, I loved being in the Midwest and, you know, small stints and everywhere else, almost 9 months in Ohio. It was a job I was very good at and I was passionate about it. Again, no issues there. So when I got to the White House, it was like, I was sitting behind a desk. I was answering like letters. I was doing so many incredible things, really. I mean, like, you know, the first daughters were like sitting in my lap. I was meeting all these amazing people, you know, giving usher tours of the White House, like wow. meeting country stars. And I, you know, beat the first lady in tennis at Camp David, you know, playing basketball with like cabinet members practically. It was a lot of stuff, cool stuff. But in my mind, I was like, this isn't what I signed up for. I signed up for like things to happen and things to change.
Right.
And I didn't feel like government was like, you know, you had to call 10 people to, you know, call one person.
Right.
I just felt disappointed. But in hindsight, like that was a sign. And I've done this many times now in my, made that same mistake in other areas.
Yeah.
And then later the wheels fall off.
Right. Right. So at this point, you've had a couple of, how you were diagnosed when you were around
18, 19.
At this point, you can't be over 30 something.
Ed, when?
Now.
No. Now I'm 33.
Yeah. So between now and then, what have you learned to avoid those triggers? What have you learned to sort of catch yourself early before the ripple becomes a tidal wave?
Great question. And probably the most important question of my life, I would say, up to date. This year, my 33rd year, so 2017, has been the most important year in that journey and probably the most important year of my life because of it, you know, because one thing for anybody listening who doesn't understand, like bipolar can destroy your life. Like you can literally lose friends, you know, girlfriends, boyfriends, husband, wives, houses, jobs, your reputation, tons of money, many, many things. So to answer your question, in 2017, I finally learned how much I needed structure, routine, good habits. Mm-hmm. So now, I mean, I'm like a military soldier. I chart my sleep every morning. I journal in the morning. I journal at night. You know, what I say is I have a bipolar journal, and then I have this thing called the 5-minute journal. If you guys never heard of the 5-minute journal, you should check it out. Mm-hmm. That's for everybody, and that's life changing.
What is it?
Takes 5 minutes. Uh-huh. In the morning, you write 3 things you're grateful for. What would make the day great if whatever happened? 3 things. And at night, you write what 3 things that were amazing that happened, and 2 things you could have done better. And that's really good.
Yeah.
That's, you know,
yeah.
My close friend gave that to me, the one who'd been with me in all the episodes.
That's something we talk about a lot here because there's a lot of physician burnout, and something that we talk about is expressing gratitude and how that actually seems to really help improve job satisfaction, your overall well-being. Something we try to do. We're not great about. I tried to get these guys to do it once.
We
deleted that episode because.
And then we're gonna do it over Thanksgiving, like it. But then we passed.
I'm pretty good at it. I've got some tricks of working that muscle.
Yeah.
But it's hard to be grateful when you're, you know, 100 miles in the ocean in a depression.
Right.
Then it's very hard to be grateful. And people always come to me and they're like, you know, I never tell anybody, oh, well, you know, you should do this or do that, because like the first thing you should do is not kill yourself.
suicide, yeah. I think, is very prevalent among bipolar 1.
Yeah, it's like 1 in 3 or 1 in 4. It's
for
a
bipolar
lot.
Disorder one. Type 1, right?
I think yeah. 1, yeah.
Yeah, and then they say, you know, people are saying, or what I've read is that when you're so depressed, you don't necessarily have the motivation to kind of do it. And then at some point, again,
the
like
you're
saying.
The real risk comes when you start to get on that climb back
yeah.
up.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to know.
One of the many risks.
Not sure if you're comfortable saying this. What is your most sort of outrageous purchase? Is there something that sticks out in your mind? Because again, the classic part of mania is just spending right. in very, like you're saying, you could lose everything.
Right.
Gambling, spending. These are features. Again, mm-hmm. if you look up a textbook, mm-hmm. and the diagnosis.
I think it was just really a lot of stupid shit. Yeah. Which adds up a
sure.
lot.
Sure. Yeah. QVC.
Yeah. The thing that really kind of gets me financially, I think, is, you know, I don't have any assets, but I had a little bit of stock passed down from yeah. like my grandpa or whatever, and I liquidated all that. Mm. And, you know, it wasn't a huge sum of money, but when I think about it, yeah. it bothers
it's
me.
It's your family.
Yeah.
That,
yeah you
that's
know,
sentimental and that.
And yeah. I would really now like to grow that. And since I don't have it, it's like I've started to start from the bottom right. and reacquire it.
Yeah.
I mean, credit cards are also the bane of like
yeah.
the manic.
I guess I've been pretty lucky in those, you know, it could be a lot worse, but I've also sure. spent a ton of money.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Both.
So you talk about these changes and how they can be really subtle. And that's something that I've heard, and it can slowly grow and slowly grow. Because of that, how, and because you're very smart, and when smart people can...
Debatable.
Well, you seem pretty damn smart, and I'm just smart enough to get what other smart people are like, so I...
You're a doctor.
See,
doctors are pretty smart.
Oh, we're all right.
Don't
we're
say
all
that.
Right. You're
don't
all right.
Say that.
Depends on the doctor.
Right,
I've met
right.
a lot of dumb doctors.
Yeah, so have we. So anyways, so you can notice these things can be so gradual that it happens before you know it. How much do you rely on other people in your life to tell you when something's going on
yeah.
or when you're changing?
I'm glad you circled back to that because I didn't fully answer. You sort of asked that before. And that's an important facet of, you know, self-care and the warning signs. Let me put you this way. I have changed my entire life. The getting up early, the going to bed early, the inventory, changed my diet, which I had never done before. I was told if I cut out wheat and sugar that, you know, that might just be the answer to everything. So I did it. And
so I became a Scientologist.
Yeah, it's been,
I don't know what happened.
Whatever
it
takes.
Work.
Whatever it takes. But but that actually was helpful. But probably the most helpful, you know, exercising, of course.
Right.
But probably the most helpful thing is what you're talking about, which, you know, some people refer to as monitoring. And I haven't been good at all. And that was really hard for me because when your sanity is being questioned, it's very hard to take someone's feedback.
Right.
You know, you get right. very defensive and you almost, yeah. and also it's very hard to see it. So one thing I did to address what you're asking is my sister was always kind of like the tough love person for me, which was hard to deal with during those yeah. times. But because I know she could do that, I've now put her in a role where once a month we sort of do a check-in.
Mm-hmm,
And the whole idea of that is so when things do start to escalate a little bit, which they inevitably do, like yeah. that'll happen for the rest of my life.
Right, right.
But when they escalate a little bit, it's like I'm used to that muscle with her of
right.
hearing it. So now it's like a trusted voice. So right. she can say, hey, I think you're a little bit up now.
Right.
Or I think you're...
Right.
Sorry, do you also have like a medical go-to person? Are you checking in frequently? Like we were talking earlier, what's your experience with the medical community?
Yeah.
Is that
I have
someone
a psychiatrist,
who's
and yeah. this is probably where the overlap will really become interesting here. I just... You know, maybe I'll regret saying this in the future, but... To me, the way the structure is and the way is devoid from reality, a term, it's just...
Would you say, though, that it's at least a useful part? Not,
oh, yeah.
I mean, something that's important that you would have to keep doing.
I think med management, you know, if you need meds, you
but,
need
well,
to see a psychiatrist.
They're good at diagnosing and medical management. I think there is a subtle difference, and we could maybe have a psychiatrist on, between, like, therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy mm-hmm. and the types of therapy. There's so many different nuances and so many different philosophies and theories and approaches to this kind of stuff. But once you have the diagnosis and you're on meds, I don't know how much time and training psychiatrists have in the therapy part of it and the monitoring part of it, like you're talking about. Yeah. I don't know that.
And I think that they would probably agree.
Well, yeah.
Like Lizzie said, we'll have to get one on. But my suspicion is they would agree that their job is only part of this process of this self-healing.
Like you and said, it's an medication.
And it's an important part of the job. Yeah. But I think understanding that it's like 10, 15, 25% is important.
Right.
I think most people think, you know, you're bipolar or whatever. That the psychiatrist is really the way forward.
It's a necessity, I would say, but you can't rely on it alone. There's a lot of work outside of that needs to be done.
Yeah. But that being said, it is really important. I've obviously got a lot from psychiatrists and medication, but I will say I would totally restructure psychiatry as a profession.
It seems like it sounds like it needs a more like holistic approach, like a psychiatrist, medication, the monitoring and that check-in, along with therapy and self-care. Like this is all just sounds like it needs to be a more kind of holistic combined approach than one part of it, which is a lot of diseases in general.
What advice do you have for doctors, not just psychiatrists, but as you travel through the medical world and you're in and out of the medical system for whatever reason, what advice do you have for doctors who are going to be dealing or talking to or seeing patients with bipolar disease?
A person in that like sort of severe acute stage, their mind is like going 1,000 miles an hour. For a doctor to be sort of nonchalant or confrontational or whatever, I mean, it's like your world is ending at that moment. Right. So I would just really urge doctors to be like have some awareness there, but it's hard. I mean,
I think it's incredibly important for someone like you to be open about something like this, because there really is sort of this stigma. There's obviously a stigma about mental disease, and people don't look at it the same way as they look at, say, cardiac disease or lung disease or kidney disease, something that's tangible, that's easy for people to understand. But it's just as real a disease, and it's just, if not more so, deadly. And it's important that someone who has the ability to intellectualize it, to describe it, and do it in a relatable way like you do, I think it's very important that someone like you does that. I think it's really good that you're doing it. We really appreciate it.
It's really brave, frankly. I mean, because there's a potential. It is a stigma, unfortunately. And I mean, going into a job interview, if someone were to ask me they wouldn't, but if that were to ever come up, I would feel pressured to lie because I don't want to not get the job, fearing that the employer is not going to want to hire someone who's maybe up and down and whatnot. And it's very brave to do that. And
thank you. And that's a real reality. I mean, it's sometimes it is hard to apply to things because you're like,
and it's private,
when they find out, you know, it does get very disconcerting. But just to appreciate what you're saying, like, I do want to be the person who eventually like inspires, you know, kids to be like, I want to be bipolar. Like, I mean, I actually do want to be that person. And I think this is good practice because I do believe I can speak about it authentically and shine a light on it in a way that's important.
In, you know, your project that you're working on, you do say that wine like changed your life. And is that related?
Originally I had wine saved my life.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Well, passion. Both.
So that's actually a really good question and important to the story is when I left the White House, I came back to the Bay Area and I started working in my family's company, which is really small. My dad started importing French oak barrels 40 years ago. And, you know, originally I felt like, I don't know if this is me. Like, you know, I worked in the White House, like I've got a big calling here.
Right.
And, but I've done that on and off, worked in the family wine business for 8 years. And it has always been like my sort of place that I've come back to after falling off the horse and sort of rebuilding myself.
Yeah.
And this year, for the first time, it feels like, okay, like I'm home. I've found a grounding and it's really helped me be grounded because the process of wine, you know, from the earth all the way to the bottle, it requires a ton of patience. You know, the farming, the grapes only present once a year. Then the alchemy of the wine, of course, and the holding the wine in barrels and then the holding wine in bottle. I mean, you're talking, it could be 2 or 3 years before anyone tastes it. For me, that's really good. And that's probably why I resisted it in the first place, because I wasn't a patient person. So yeah, so I'm selling the barrels all over the West Coast, and I'm also working on that wine project you mentioned, which that actually is supposed to be like a pretty raw, authentic take on both my life and how wine has sort of been a balancing force for me. So, you know, we'll see if it goes.
So you don't mean necessarily just like drinking the wine. You mean the process of understanding the process from ground to glass.
Oh, I was saying treat all mental health with alcohol. My bad.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a good question. But no, I mean, certainly it brings people together. You know, that's the final gift is you can share wine around a table and the community building, which I'm a community builder. So I like that element too. But I mean the process from start to finish because for me, being bipolar has been such a process. Finding myself has been a huge, huge process.
Right.
And, you know, I think when 40, 60 years from now, when the history books are finished, I will have like found my footing, my solid foundation in wine. I'm definitely not stopping at wine.
Yeah.
But I will be, you know, at least like in some respects, the wine guy. Because it just, you know, whether the show works or not, like, you know, I want to be the face of American wine.
Well,
so.
And also the poster child to encourage kids to drink. Become bipolar.
Yeah.
All of it.
So you keep us updated on that.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, guys. Thanks for all the work you're doing. It's it's really a great podcast.
And, thanks, you know,
really admire you, Joe. A lot of courage.
No, thank you so much for talking
doing
about
a good
it.
Thing
but
here.
Really your mission, though, of making the medical profession and doctors more user-friendly and less scary. People need that.
Thank you.
It's important.
We barely scratched the surface of bipolar and bipolarism. I'm not sure if I'm going to
bipolarity.
We have barely scratched the surface of it. Yeah. I'm sure we'll have to have you back on
some
point
some good
in the
work.
Future.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. We really do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
It's super important. So thanks, man.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
All anecdotes and patient-related details were changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.